will be on stream connectivity, and we are joined by Dr. Joe Archibald and Brian Buchanan. Joe has a PhD in biological and environmental engineering, where she focused on watershed modeling and hydrology. And she's currently a professor at Humboldt State University, teaching on environmental resources engineering. And Brian conducts research in hydrology and water resource management, including everything from geospatial analysis, ecology, and stream restoration. Let us welcome Joe.
Thanks so much, Julia, and thanks everyone for coming. We're really excited to share a little bit of our knowledge with you today and for the rest of the our time here at Holden. So let's see if I can move forward. Yeah, so our objectives for today's talk, we'll just do a quick introduction, and Julia's already kind of introduced us, so it'll be really quick for that. We're going to talk a little bit about what is aquatic connectivity and why is it important. And then we'll talk about stream barriers. So these are really the concrete things that we have done to impact aquatic connectivity. And so we can think about some solutions. We'll talk about some examples, especially I'll talk about a couple of examples in this region, the big scale ones. And some case studies in the New York Hudson River estuary, which is where Brian and I have both worked. We've done most of our work in this topic in New York State, so that's why we've got a little bit of information there. And then also in the Puget Sound region. And so we'll think about some ways that you can explore local barriers if you're interested later on in kind of following up about this topic.
And you can see this bucolic scene here. This is Joe's family's hometown in Kendall, England. And, you know, a lot of, you can probably spot a very obvious barrier. It doesn't seem like much, does it? Mm-hmm. It's about probably a 2.5 foot high barrier, which is enough to be, essentially is the Hoover Dam, mm-hmm. To most fish species that happen to be in this river. It doesn't look like much. We see them all the time, especially in the Northeast. We'll talk more about that in a minute.
And then also, is this still on?
I was making some adjustments as there was maybe some feedback.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Jonah. And then just as a side note, I'll just highlight some words that might be unfamiliar to you in red, just so that it's a signal to me to remember to define it, and so you can just be aware it's probably not a word you've heard before. So introduce ourselves. So yeah, you know, we're Brian and Joe, and we have a daughter, Isla, who's here with us. So she's running around right now in Holden. Brian and I met, we were both doing our PhDs at Cornell University in New York, so there's a strong New York connection there. And then, like I said, we did most of our work with stream connectivity in the Hudson River watershed area, which is this shaded region here in New York State. And currently, I'm teaching at Humboldt State University. I'm in a lecturer position, so I'm really just teaching the whole time. I'm not doing as much research anymore. And Brian's the one that's really in the streams doing a lot of this kind of work, too. So.
Yeah, it's less field-based than I was hoping, largely because of COVID, I hope. We'll see. Hopefully we'll get out in the field a bit more now.
Yeah.
But you would think it would be the opposite. We'd be out in the field a lot during COVID. But I'm also doing some, I guess I'd call it maybe an environmental analyst, a researcher, doing some like machine learning modeling, which is using a bunch of remotely sensed data, so like data from satellites. And so it's big data sets that you're analyzing and trying to predict certain environmental things, and we might get into a little bit of that too. So.
Okay. We're talking about freshwater ecosystems for this talk, so just want to define what are freshwater ecosystems. So these are water-based ecosystems that are not influenced by tides, not coastal ecosystems. It would include things like streams, rivers, lakes, ponds, all of those we consider freshwater ecosystems. So just some things to think about, facts about these systems. Freshwater ecosystems cover less than 1% of the Earth's surface, but they're home to more than 10% of all animals that we know of, and 33% of vertebrates. So animals with backbones, sort of the higher animals that you notice more. On Thursday and Friday, we'll talk about some macroinvertebrate animals that you often overlook and don't notice. Unfortunately, freshwater biodiversity is declining fast. So by some metrics, over 80% of the biodiversity in these freshwater systems have declined since 1970. So some sort of specific examples of this: freshwater fish have the highest extinction rate of all vertebrates that we know of. And then freshwater mussels are considered the most endangered group of animals in North America. So, we often don't think about the mussels as so important, but they're really an important indicator of how is the health of the system, and it's not great, unfortunately. So just something to think about. I'll give you 10 seconds to think about. Why do you think this might be? Anyone want to kind of share? Why might freshwater systems in particular be suffering? Yeah?
Run off from lawns and golf courses.
Yeah.
Have a high nutrient value.
Great point. Yes, absolutely. So, runoff and farmland, runoff from farmland creating pollution problems, specifically nutrients. Yeah.
Additional heat in the water that's becoming more warm all the time.
Yeah, great point. And because the temperature of the water is related to the amount of oxygen that can be held in the water. So it's a really big problem. If you raise up the average temperature of a water system, a lot of animals suddenly will not be able to get the oxygen that they need. And they're just going to be more vulnerable to all other kinds of things that could harm them. Great point. Thanks. Yeah.
Man-made manipulation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Control rivers. And
absolutely. Yeah. Great point. And the other thing is we all need water too, right? So we're often developing right along these systems because it's very convenient to us. We want water as well, and unfortunately we're not always the best stewards of this really important resource. Great. Any other ideas? And so those are all very important points. And the other thing too is if we think about especially streams, which we're focusing on, they're very linear systems. And so you can, if you make a disruption to one point in a system, in a linear system, everything upstream, everything downstream of that, and upstream as well, is affected by that. And so it's like one point can suddenly have a very destructive effect on many miles of streams upstream and downstream. Whereas in a land-based system, you might make a square mile of disturbance, and there's enough area around it that the ecosystem can remain intact. Okay, so this idea of aquatic connectivity, that's an important term that we're going to talk about. So basically, there are two ways that we can think about aquatic connectivity. We can think about how connected a stream is or a lake system is to floodplains and riparian areas. So that means, if this is a river here, the riparian area would be right along the side of the river. And this would be called the riparian area. And it's kind of an in-between. It's usually, we'd think of it as dry land, but it does occasionally get flooded and it becomes really part of that river system. And it's an incredibly important land-water connection there. And again, because we love being near water, this is often where we develop and change things in a river system. So aquatic connectivity, we need the connectivity with the banks and the riparian areas. And we also need connectivity upstream and downstream. So that could also be thought of as longitudinal connectivity, going up and downstream. So let's think about what are some stream barriers then. Really, it's anything that impedes the movement of aquatic organisms, either laterally or longitudinally, right? And it doesn't mean that it has to be a complete barrier. So something can still be considered a stream barrier, even if, you know, 50% of animals that normally would be able to go upstream can still go upstream. It's still impeding their movement, and if you have enough of those, it creates a real problem and a real decline in the populations. And the other thing is, we can think about stream barriers as, they can be man-made or they can be natural. So there certainly are natural barriers that we encounter as well. So here's the most dramatic natural barrier I can think of. There's Niagara Falls in New York. And really, I don't know of any species that can swim upstream that. Maybe there's something that we haven't discovered yet, but
There are some species that can climb up waterfalls in Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
They have little suckers, essentially, on the bottom, and they kind of manage to squiggle their way up. And actually, American eel can go up. They've detected them over dams that are over 80 to 90 feet high. So you imagine, essentially, a water snake somehow slithering up an 80, 90-foot high dam. It's quite remarkable. But, so a lot of times people say, well, okay, because American eel aren't doing that great for a number of reasons. There's parasites, in the Sargasso Sea where they go out and they mate. That's an issue. But, so they're not doing great. And a lot of people are like, oh, so what? I mean, we don't have to care about all these dams. They're going to get over them anyways. Well, a fraction of them get over, not all of them. It's not easy for them. And imagine, you're migrating from the Sargasso Sea all the way up, maybe perhaps up into the Hudson River, and all the way up the river against the current. Sometimes you have the tide behind you, but then you got to go upstream, all these little tributaries. A lot of energy is expended, and then you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dams, perhaps, that you have to get over. And each one is reducing about 90% of the population. So they're not able to access that habitat. And so when Joe was talking earlier about how freshwater ecosystems are particularly sensitive, it's because you have all of these cumulative impacts. Multiple dams, you have pollution from lawns coming in, so you have eutrophication, you have any number of things, like modifications of the physical habitat in the channel. So anyways, I'll stop there.
Great, thanks, Brian. Okay, so let's look at some examples of natural barriers. The first most obvious is waterfalls, as we talked about. But also, it can be smaller, just little shoots in a stream, like a rapid. Again, some species might be able to get up here in some proportion, but not all. Even just riffles, really turbulent ripples, known as critical riffles, can be barriers. But then let's look at some examples of man-made barriers. Biggest, maybe most obvious one is a dam. So this is the Elwood Dam. So we were talking a little bit about this at the beginning. So this was a major dam on the Olympic Peninsula that's actually since come down, and hopefully we'll have time to talk about that. But not all dams are that big. So here's another example of a dam that Brian did some work on trying to remove in New York State.
We just removed it, in fact.
Yep. So that
as of a few months ago, which, you wouldn't think that. I mean, look, it doesn't look like much. Essentially, it's an old pile of rubble from the mid-1800s. It's an old masonry dam that's somewhat degraded as it is, and you wouldn't think it would take a whole lot of effort to get that out. It's not serving any purpose. There's no mill. There's no hydroelectricity there. But it took years and a ridiculous amount of money to pull that little dam out. It was over $200,000, and what amounted to an hour's worth of work with a backhoe, because of a lot of reasons, one of which is some states don't have the most progressive environmental regulations regarding restoration. So we call it green tape. You got red tape, where there's green tape, and it makes it hard to do good things for the environment sometimes. But we're building momentum. And we're streamlining things as each project that we accomplish makes it easier for the next. So,
also, this is like a little dam, a weir. So these are often put in place in rivers to sort of help with measurements and just sort of controlling the flow at a certain point. That can be a barrier. Stream channelization is a really common one. So in urban areas, you know, people want to be as close to the river as possible. And also, you know, this helps flood control in urban areas because you want to get the water out as fast as possible. So they channelize the river. Unfortunately, there's a huge, I mean, they just basically destroyed the ecosystem there doing that, making that channelization. So there's no connectivity with that riparian area now. And then something we don't think about very often is wherever a stream meets a road, that is going to be a barrier, right, of some way. And it's something that we just drive over and don't think about it. But this map here is showing, you know, the density of roads over the globe. So you can see, obviously, very urban areas have this over 1,000 meters of roads per kilometer squared. And so these places are going to be really most impacted by stream barriers because there's so many roads.
Yeah, think of how many barriers you likely drove over just getting here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hundreds, most likely. And another interesting thing, too, is a lot of these roadside ditches, depending on the system, but in like the Northeast, for instance, it's a bit wetter, and in the Pacific Northwest, it's pretty wet. And the roadside ditches look pretty innocuous. You don't pay much attention to them. They seem like they're only the only purpose they serve is, you know, essentially keeping water off the roads and funneling it off to a stream. Well, they also have pretty significant hydrologic impacts to their receiving streams. So, you can increase peak flows. For instance, all these little roadside ditches that you drove over, didn't pay much attention to, that flow onto the culverts, they're rerouting all of that natural runoff that should have just kind of slowly gone down the hill slope, rerouting it very quickly to the to the closest stream. And so you get these high peak flows and much more flooding and disruption to the ecosystems potentially. So anyways, stop there.
Great, so let's look at some examples of when a stream meets a road. So this is the most common. When you have a really small stream, it'll usually be put into a culvert or two culverts, right? So basically, a culvert is just a big pipe that's going to take water and send it effectively where you want to go. And again, oftentimes you don't even notice they're there. So you'll just drive over them and not think about them. You're probably a little bit more aware when you're driving over a bridge, because then it's a bit more visible. So this is a much, you know, it's not nearly as much of a barrier in terms of upstream and downstream. You still got you've got a bit of a barrier laterally to the riparian area, but this is much less of an impact. So let's think about why aquatic connectivity is important for ecosystems. So it is important for reproduction of animals and plants, all types of species that live in streams need access to move for their reproductive cycle. Access to food for aquatic animal species. Thermal refugia, so that's this idea of, you know, just even in a natural cycle, even if we haven't modified the system much, there's going to be a hot period of many streams that are going to be difficult for many animal species to survive. And so when you have a nicely well-connected system, those animals can move into the cooler parts of the river system, move into those small tributaries or cool air shaded areas. Avoiding predation, genetic diversity. So of course you want to have as much movement available within your population to be able to have a healthy genetic diversity. Access to nutrients, and for better water quality. Also, sediment transport is it's kind of a subset of water quality, but this can be a really big problem when we have projects in the stream that alter the way that the stream is connected, because sediment will get trapped behind barriers, and that sediment in small doses is really needed, necessary for organisms downstream and ecosystems downstream. So let's look at a hypothetical example of a fish species, let's say, that's its natural habitat is this purple highlighted region of this stream system here. So the black lines here are, you know, tributaries of a stream. And the purple highlighted area, that's where this fish species live. So now imagine we start to develop in this area. and there's a road that's built through here. So now suddenly we have four barriers in this stream system. So what's going to happen here? Let's imagine that these are actually complete barriers for this species of fish. So the fish really cannot move upstream and downstream at those four locations. What does that mean for this population? That previously it had been one big population where there can be some genetic mixing. In this case, now suddenly we don't have one population of fish. We have five separate populations of fish, much smaller habitat for them to be able to access for all their needs. And very likely in this kind of a situation, what happens is some of those just aren't suitable for that species, for any individual of that species to live. So within one life cycle, the fish is now not present in those three locations there. It doesn't have everything the fish needs to survive. But there still are two regions where, okay, that fish might still be there, but it's not going to be as resilient. It doesn't have the chance to, maybe in the warm summer months, used to go up here and hide from the hot water, but it can't. And the genetic diversity is really severely cut off as well. So now, if you get another disturbance to that system, that might be the end of the fish in this whole stream system. Yeah. So we have to think of it like that, not just, okay, but they're still there, but they have less maybe sustainability to be there in the long term. So we can also think about how, so we saw some examples of what are barriers, but what exactly about that barrier, what about that artificial addition to the stream makes it a barrier? So the first thing that is a drop. So anything like a little dam or a culvert, many of these structures will have a drop of water that fish and other organisms just cannot swim up. Okay, so that will be a barrier. But it's not just that. Also, it can be a change in velocity. So if you're putting a stream into a pipe, a smaller cross-sectional area for the water to go through, suddenly the water speeds up and it can be too fast for organisms to be able to go upstream. Turbulence. So here, there's a drop here too, but actually this fish, you might notice there's a jumping fish here. Fish actually seems like it can jump okay, but it's confused. It's not going the right place, and that's because the water is so chaotic, the fish really is disoriented.
It's actually a juvenile salmon too. And they had another video of this exactly like this of an adult trying to do the same thing and missing the bullseye over and over again.
Yeah, so eventually it might get up, but then this kind of illustrates it tires them out, right? So it makes it harder than the next thing it meets. Depth of the water, too. So a uniform pipe doesn't give the water a chance to be deep enough for organisms to swim up there. And then length. If it's a really long, dark pipe, a fish might just not be willing to go up there. Maybe the structure in the stream itself doesn't act as a barrier, but it can kind of collect other debris and become a bit of a barrier. So here, this culvert system has just accumulated a lot of debris that now fish aren't able to get through and swim up. And then really important to think about is the cumulative impact. So again, most organisms, if they need to be traveling up and downstream, they're not going to just encounter one of these things. They're going to be encountering many.
And that's what happened there, by the way. There were multiple of these small dams that don't seem like much, and the salmon could actually get above all of them. They weren't so severe that they couldn't make it above them, but it just was so many of them in a row. They're already at the end of their life cycle, right? And they've already expended a lot of energy just getting to the stream. So it was just too much for this particular group of salmon to really access the spawning habitat that they were trying to find.
Yeah. So here, just to kind of refresh your memory or to check your memory, what kind of barrier is this?
Culvert.
Yeah, good. And then what are some of the sort of the mechanisms that this particular culvert is acting as a barrier?
Turbulence.
Turbulence, velocity, yeah, great.
Drop.
Great, excellent. Let's see, did I find anything else? Oh yeah, maybe length. We can't really tell from this picture, but it also might be such a long dark. Yeah, great. And it could be, again, most likely as part of a cumulative barrier in that stream. Good news about that culvert is this is one of the ones that has been improved. This is a photo from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so it was identified as a barrier, and they have switched to this much more natural stream system going through the culvert. So it's still a culvert. It's still not as ideal as an unmodified stream, but this is going to let most organisms complete their life cycle there. So big improvement. And also, side benefit, it helps prevent flooding as well because it's a much bigger culvert. Okay, so again, this is the Hudson River Estuary Watershed, where Brian and I both did some work on identifying culverts and dams and barriers and thinking about how to remove them. So some interesting facts about that system is that there are 10,000 stream miles and an estimated 13,000 barriers. Most of those are culverts, but there are also dams in that watershed. And then there are... So in addition to the culvert, the barrier problem, there's also very identified risk of climate change increasing flooding in that system, which actually, it's two big problems, but actually the solutions kind of are the same for both of those, so it kind of lends a bit more momentum for getting rid of these barriers. And then also to highlight, there are over 150 species of concern in that watershed. So. A very important one to be focusing on. So just a couple of the species that might be of interest. These are species that really do depend on being able to move completely upstream and downstream for their life cycles. So there's the Atlantic sturgeon. It has an anadromous life cycle, so it's similar to the salmon that you all, I'm sure, have heard a lot about on the Pacific Coast. That means that it needs to travel up into the tributaries upstream to reproduce, and then will go out to sea in order to get the nutrients it needs to get big. It is an EPA endangered status for New York population, and it has a lifespan of 60 years, so it's really quite an amazing, iconic species. it can get up to 800 pounds, so if you're really, really lucky, you could find one that big. And then another one, American eel, is really interesting. It actually has a catadromous life cycle, which is the opposite. So that means it actually goes out into the ocean to reproduce, but needs to come up into the streams in order to grow. And so it's a really neat life history story. They migrate to the Sargasso Sea. So this here is the Sargasso Sea. So the eel are coming down here, all the way out here to reproduce. It's amazing they're able to do that. And even though, as Brian mentioned, they can swim up dams, there's a tenfold decrease in the number for each barrier that is encountered. So it's a big problem there. As I mentioned, climate change is causing a particular problem of flooding in the Northeast. So here, this is from 2014, so it's possibly higher than this, but there's already been observed a 70% increase in the most intense rain events in the Northeast, which means that when we have heavy rains, we're getting bigger floods coming through our stream systems. and so when a flood reaches a stream in a culvert, this is what can happen. So it blows out, the culvert can't handle that amount of water, and it blows out the whole culvert and the whole road. So this is, I don't know, millions of dollars of damage on that road?
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, this really, the Department of Transportation really wants to prevent this. Turns out Department of Transportation has more funding a lot of times than the Fish and Wildlife does. So when they get involved, then there's a lot more potential to actually improve these barriers, and so it can help mitigate both of these problems.
And there's several hurricanes in the last decade or so up along the East Coast, and it wreaked havoc on the infrastructure like bridges and especially culverts all throughout places like Vermont and New Hampshire, New York. They blew out thousands of culverts, did mm-hmm. lots and lots of damage. But the good news is, in some cases, depressingly not in all, they didn't resize them or to accommodate necessarily more flow to kind of make it more resilient in the next storm. They did for some, and they managed to make them, some of them, they managed to make better in terms of fish passage. So like some of those other culverts that she showed earlier had an arch to them. They were able to do some of the projects like that. But unfortunately, when it hits all at once and you have a big epic event like a hurricane and it wipes out so many, that's not really the greatest time. It is more expensive to do these in a fish-friendly way. And so when you have an epic one that wipes out so many thousands of them all at once, it's very difficult to not just, well, it's an emergency, we just got to put something in there. And so they just typically will go in and just throw in whatever they happen to have laying around, honestly, when they're not necessarily always sizing these things in those instances. So we're trying to be a little bit more progressive, and Joe's going to get more into kind of optimizing these things.
Yeah. So you don't want to wait until this happens, yeah. obviously. And so instead, now there are loads and loads of groups in the New York Hudson River Estuary region that are working together, the county groups, environmental groups, transportation groups. Let's try to identify culverts that might flood, but also have connectivity issues to proactively replace them before a disaster happens. So this is a little bit of a project that we worked on, identifying these red culverts here. There are a lot of them, are the most high risk for flooding and should be examined for also connectivity so that we can kind of improve them for both of those issues. So here's another example of a culvert replacement, this one in the New York region. So again, two culverts got replaced by this much more fish-friendly bridge. Okay, so now, yeah, so let's look also what's happening in Washington. Washington has a lot of work happening as well. We haven't been directly involved, but we read a lot of resources from Washington because it's a really progressive, it's at the front edge of this. A lot is happening here. In Washington State, the basically 70,000 miles of river in the state. More than 14,000 barriers have been identified. And there are now state and federal laws that mandate that all of these barriers are removed. Because people in Washington, people recognize, and there's been tribal lawsuits as well, that in particular because of the salmon and the salmon's life cycle, needing that access is essential for their populations. And we're seeing so many cases of streams where the populations are just less than 1% of what they were historically. So restoring that connectivity is essential for increasing those populations.
I was going to say, so in a sad way, Washington State's actually lucky in that they have some iconic species that aren't doing that well,
it's like motivational.
The salmon. So it's, in other words, it provides the impetus for state and local and federal regulations to help fix the problem, because we have a number of federally endangered species, and other places aren't quite so lucky, and so that helps get a lot of work done in Washington State. And as Joe said, it's actually quite progressive. Washington State's doing a really good job of cataloging these things and replacing them where they need it. And these little red dots there are really only emphasizing the ones that have been mapped on, by the Washington Department of Transportation. And it's not, you're not looking at county roads. So if you actually had a full map, you'd probably be just almost all red, depending on the size of your dots. But anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Brian. And so you can see a lot of this work is happening at the county level. So this is Thurston County is kind of projecting out how long is it going to take them to replace all their culverts. They identified that they had 353 barriers under their purview and, how that's going to play out to replace all of them. But the work is happening. It's slow and it is costly. So for example, from the Department of Transportation of Washington State, so again, that's just the state level, but it is happening at other levels as well, 14 barriers were improved and connected 45 miles of habitat. So if you are interested in exploring this topic more, like Brian said, Washington State is just got incredible online tools that you can go and take a look. So here, this is called SalmonScape. It's run by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. So you can take a look at what salmon-bearing streams are in your region, and it is color-coded so you can see, you know, documented presence is blue here. So in these areas, this is around Seattle. There's a lot of streams that have salmon in them, but as you go upstream, you see where the spawning habitat is. So it's further upstream in those smaller tributaries. But then there are also some areas that are noted as purple. There's potential for salmon to live there, but it's blocked currently. So then, you know, you could look at this and see, well, where's a really important place to maybe put some attention, public attention, to let's advocate to remove these barriers here. So that's a nice tool, SalmonScape. And another really nice tool is the Washington State Fish Passage tool. And this is, it's amazing. You can just click on any of these little triangles up here, and it'll show you a documented barrier in a stream, and they'll have like a little bit of information about what that barrier is, and they'll have photos. Here is just a random one I clicked on. It's a culvert. They show a picture, and they'll also give a little history. Sometimes they'll have a dot that's, you know, a triangle that's, this one has been improved. So I really encourage you to take a look at these tools. They can help you think about what streams you might be able to kind of advocate around if you're interested in doing that in your communities.
And it helps to advocate for sure, because especially in regards to dams, it's actually very, as I mentioned, very difficult to remove almost anywhere, especially the larger the dam, the larger the impoundment, so the larger the pond or lake. And people typically, you know, and rightly so, I understand, get very attached to their ponds and their lakes, even if they're artificial. They also get attached to the waterfall, you know, or, you know, essentially the dam spillway. And they are beautiful. I've taken a few photographs too and thought, you know, these are quite lovely. And so it actually, financial considerations end up being a barrier to barrier removal a lot of times. But actually what we're finding is most of the time they're social barriers. So people just don't want you to pull out their dam. They don't want to lose their pond. And we understand that, and we try to work with communities or landowners to try to come to some sort of compromise where possible. In some cases, we've been able to actually maintain some portion of the original sort of lentic or pond habitat and free up the river, or do a partial breach of a dam. I mean, there's some kind of in-betweens, but the social considerations end up being one of the largest things that prevents us from being able to bring these dams down. So, advocacy is definitely helpful.
Yeah.
Is this picture a good solution to put a drop like that?
This one here?
Yes,
I believe this one is actually, this is a fish passage culvert here. I actually found this photo a while ago, so I can't remember, but I believe this one this was the before photo, and then this was the after photo, where they, it's a little hard to see here, but there's like a thinner channel inside this culvert that allows for low flows. It's a deeper flow then, so the fish can kind of swim up it in a sort of curvy way, and then when there's high flow, the pipe just kind of fills up. So it's an improvement. It would be definitely an improvement over just a straight pipe like that, which has a drop at the end of it.
And so that's a retrofit, generally speaking, so it's a compromise. You don't have to rip the whole thing out, which, you know, it's quite expensive. So you can actually slide these things up in there and to try to help increase fish pastures, essentially. So they're called baffles, you know, or little weirs, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Thanks.
Can you go back one slide?
Sure. Is this one or the SalmonScape?
Okay, so right there where it says Black Diamond, and if you have the purple potential,
Yeah.
Okay, so Mud Mountain Dam sits right there.
And there?
The Kent, Auburn, Renton Valley used to flood every year, annually. And they put that in there for flood control.
Uh-huh.
They didn't put in any sort of fish net. And it would be really difficult. I mean, 100,000 people could lose their homes if that was gone. So is are the scientists working on technologies to, well, or engineering to create fish ladders that could open, potentially open up,
yeah,
those that are lost, those habitats that are lost?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, definitely there are workarounds, and so, you know, I know there are a lot of dams that do have either fish ladders, or sometimes they even truck fish up, you know, and the really kind of difficult ones. Yeah. You know, ideally, you would want an unimpeded natural stream passage. But, of course, there are going to be situations where, yeah, you can't flood this valley here. And so I unfortunately, I don't know any of the details about this. This was kind of just a screenshot I took of the Seattle area. But yeah, that would be interesting to find out more about what are the options, and I'm surprised they haven't put a fish ladder in. Or yeah, I don't know if there's something making that infeasible for them there, but that is a common solution as well.
Yeah, a lot of fish ladders have had mixed success. And you know, they're working on improving the technologies. It seems like a tried and true way is, like Joe said, you go down, you shock them, collect his or net them and put them in a truck and you just truck them up. But it's also kind of an odd way of helping a creature reach its spawning destination. But yes, they are working all the time on improving these things. But that's also kind of a battle that people like American Rivers, who advocate for free flowing rivers, come up against, is like, well, just put a fish ladder on it. Well, what are we worried about? It's like, well, they don't really actually work that well. And oftentimes what we find is they require actually quite a bit of maintenance. And there's not often funding for the maintenance portion of it. So we get funding, we get a federal grant, we can put it in, great. 5 years down the road, whose job is it to go out and actually maintain these things and to fix them when they're broken? Well, I don't know who's going to pay for that. That's often not funded. So that's definitely a solution. And the folks that I know that work at places like American Rivers are not against it. But, you know, there's caveats, pros and cons.
Yeah, you have to be really careful with thinking that a fish ladder, that means that the dam's okay, that, you know, the dam isn't really a big disruption to the ecosystem, because you might be focusing on, like, a specific species of fish, too, and they might be able to use that fish ladder, but other species aren't, and it's, there are other considerations as well that barrier is affecting the stream. Yeah. Great questions. Yeah.
Impoundments affect water temperature, and the species don't survive anyway.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, that's a big problem with dams, that the water heats up because it's not moving as it should. Yeah.
Talk about beavers.
Building natural dams.
Oh, you mean like, are they a problem?
Sure.
I heard once that, like, we've lost 80% of our freshwater surface area since beavers have been, like, trapped out in North America. Something crazy, there used to be way more surface water due to beavers. And I'm just curious, those are obviously impediments of some kind, but what role is your stance on beavers? Most people don't like a beaver in the backyard.
Yeah, that's a great question.
I'm a personally quite a fan of beavers.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of fishing actually in beaver ponds, but they're you know, their structures are far more porous.
Sure.
So you'd be surprised what a fish can actually navigate. If there's running water, which there is through every beaver dam, the fish go right through it. It's not much of an impediment, if at all, in general. In fact, they actually make really great rearing habitat for a lot of species. So, like, where you find more beavers, oftentimes you find better spawning and kind of rearing success. And they find, like, you know, a lot of, you know, juveniles and Chinook salmon actually have much higher survivability because of the presence of beavers creating these lovely deep habitat, oftentimes with a lot of woody structure in it. that prevents things like, you know, herons and cranes from eating them all. So
is there stuff happening to do the work of the beaver?
Oh, you mean like...
Yeah, is that like part of ecology these
interesting
days?
Yeah, well...
Are there projects that simulate beaver ponds and stuff like that?
I've never worked on one. but yes, a lot of times, and maybe the objective isn't necessarily to simulate precisely a beaver pond, but oftentimes they do create like alcoves and backwater habitats, backwater mm-hmm. pond, mm-hmm. you know, same idea. You're creating this slow, lower velocity area that's typically deeper that provides essentially the same function that, almost the same function that a beaver dam does. So yes.
No, we have a situation in Wisconsin where a trout stream, native trout, beaver built the dam, the water temperature increased, trout are gone.
Oh.
DNR did dynamite the dam, trout never came back. You could say nature was at work, but was it?
Sure.
Did humans influence why the beavers built the dam? You can go on and on until the cows come home.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, it was a native population of trout wiped out by the beavers.
That's a shame, yeah. But, you know, it's interesting. That could have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Maybe the system was already stressed. Because you could imagine in a more natural system, maybe the trout would have gone somewhere else for a little while and then come back up when the beaver dam was breached.
Yeah, because they're quite deformable, obviously.
Yeah, they'd
only last
forever.
Typically a few years, you know, maybe a decade. But, you know, we're building our dam. I mean, we have so many dams, at least in the Northeast, just because people have been there longer, that have been there for hundreds of years. And they don't even necessarily look like much. That one I showed you, you know, I mean, from the mid-1800s, still there, you know. It's been there for so long, it's really quite remarkable, honestly, the kind of masonry skills folks used to have back in the day. But did you have a question?
I did. Just the fact that you're from, you know, New York and Hudson River, I mean, is there some hope along the way? Because just in terms of pollution, Hudson's come a long way, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of
restoration. Oh, yeah. I still eat the fish, personally. But.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Oh, I still don't eat the fish, personally. But,
yeah,
but.
Yeah, but I mean, does that give us some impetus and some hope for us in terms of stewardship moving forward, that there has been some success?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
I think so.
Yes, I hope so. And actually, we do have a few more slides. Hopefully this will give you some hope. Too, if you haven't heard, how many of you have heard of the Elwha Dam Removal Project? Awesome, great. So have any of you visited the site? Awesome, cool. Yeah, so this is a really neat, relatively local example of a river that was dammed for 100 years. Two dams. So this is in the majority of the watershed of the Elwha River lies within the Olympic National Park. So it's a really pristine watershed. It was a very, very productive salmon fishery for all five species of Pacific salmon. And then, sadly, these two dams were put in the early 1900s that just completely cut off the salmon from being able to go upstream. Starting in the 80s, local tribes in particular spearheaded this effort to remove the dams, and it just seemed like a hopeless case at that point. It seemed like nobody would take them seriously, and that, of course, these dams weren't going to be removed. But in fact, they were, and they were removed in, I believe it was 2011. So they were removed relatively recently, both of them. And this was an extremely important case because this was the largest dam removal project in the world. It was, you know, are fish going to come back? People were really worried. You know, the fish haven't been able to travel up these streams for 100 years. Their populations had been just utterly decimated. They are already seeing fish coming way up into this watershed. This is wonderful because it gives hope that we can remove some other really big dams. I have some pictures of it. Okay, so here are the five salmon species. You know, they need to be able to move up and downstream, get back out to sea, and come back up to reproduce. We often just think about the fish, but actually, you know, lots of research has been done on things like this is American Dipper. It does, its population does better when there's salmon in the streams nearby because, you know, that's it's a food source.
They do some experiments where they track these marine-derived nutrients, and they can use isotopes and things to figure out. They'll go up and they'll sample trees, for instance, in the riparian zones, the nearby stream areas, and they can actually detect how much of the nutrients within, like, just the vegetation actually came from the salmon, and same with the birds. And it's amazing the impact that the salmon can have on not just the aquatic systems, but the terrestrial systems and the avian systems around them.
Yeah, really, it's like we think of it as just an aquatic ecosystem, but it's an everything ecosystem. So yeah, also black bears, lots of studies on how they do, other all kinds of terrestrial systems, we see that they do better when salmon are in their streams. And so, you know, here's a picture. This is a former Lake Aldwell. So this is what the reservoir looked like, and then the dam was removed. So this is a picture pretty recently after the dam was removed, 2016. And you can see, so one of the issues when you remove a dam that everyone was worried about is, you know, the connectivity, it's not just impedes water flow, it impedes sediment flow. So there's little particles of soil that get transported with water into rivers, and that's normal and natural part of the ecosystem. But when you have too much sediment, that can kill fish, it can kill all kinds of aquatic organisms. So what they were really worried about is when they remove this dam, what's going to happen to all that sediment? You know, so there's large truckloads of sediment being brought out, but they also just relied on the river to bring some out. And so they're really, in particular, concerned about what's going to happen in the first couple of years after the dam's going to be removed. Is all that sediment going to kill fish and other organisms downstream?
And speaking of social barriers I mentioned earlier, when most people think of popping a dam out, they think that what's going to be left behind is a swampy mud pit, kind of like the photo on the right, you know, which is not exactly, but you can see it's got a lot of sediment in it.
That's what
a lot of people perceive, but the thing is that it's a very temporary thing. It's very resilient systems. If you remove the stressor, they heal themselves quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we try to convey, and we're trying to use images more and renderings more to show them, like, this is what it's actually going to look like. You just need to wait 2 or 3 years. Yes, the first season, it doesn't look great. By the second season, you'd be amazed. Once the vegetation comes back in, it's really quite remarkable. The before and after photos, you don't have to wait long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so here is the Glines Canyon Dam that was upstream. So it was this one was actually in the national park. And this is a photo I took when we were out there in 2015, 2016. So this was just a few years again after the dam removal. You can see all of these plants. This green over here is just young plants growing into that floodplain area that had previously been submerged under the reservoir there. So there was, again, like I said, the worry about that sediment, that's often measured using turbidity, so how cloudy is the water downstream. This is kind of the lethal threshold. So there were points of time where there were high turbidity after the dam was removed. So the dam was removed starting in 2011 here, and then completely removed looks like just after December 2011. And then we saw these spikes. It was concerning, especially for pink salmon, which only have that one, like every 2 years they return. So they were worried that it would wipe out like a whole population of pink salmon. But despite this, you know, relatively short-term period of stress to the system, like I said, we're seeing a lot of improvements. We're seeing fish going upstream. But there is also a positive to all that sediment coming through. It built back up the Elwha River Delta. And so here, this is an incredibly important habitat as well. It's like an estuarine system where many saltwater species, you know, their juvenile will be reared in this area. So all that sediment comes out and builds this delta. And now they think the delta is pretty much where it would naturally be if the river had not been dammed. So that's really exciting to see. Okay, so that's the pink salmon, again, sort of where they're moving upstream after this dam removal. And then we do have to think about how long recovery takes after such a major shift in the system. So again, turbidity and suspended sediment concentration goes way up, you know, after a dam removal project in the short term, right? Hours, days to months. Then when we are looking at, you know, stream bed particle size, that's important for habitat, juvenile fish density, invertebrate density, you know, that could be months and years. And then in decades, maybe we'll start to see salmon populations like they were 100 years ago. That's the hope, right? But it's not going to be immediate, but it's just something that we're working towards. If you haven't been out to the Olympic Peninsula and seen the Owlett River and that dam project, I really encourage you to see it. I think it's incredibly inspirational. And then there's another one coming up. This is the Klamath River Dam Removal Project. This is in Oregon and Northern California, near where we live. These dams, three major dams, are slated to be removed. Actually, four major dams in the Klamath River basin. And they're slated to be removed in a couple of years. Again, this has been like a decades-long process of making this happen. But it's going to free up, at least 420 miles. So I think it was 70 miles of stream was freed up with the Elwha project. That was the biggest dam removal project when it happened. This one's going to be even bigger. It's going to be huge. So and it's not going to happen anytime too soon, because the salmon in the Klamath River are really suffering right now. So this is a really exciting project that we're eagerly looking to see what's going to happen there as well.
And so while we in the U.S. seem to be removing dams more than building them, other countries like, you know, China and a lot of South American countries are building more dams. They're in a different stage of development, you might say. And so some projects are recognizing, and I was involved in a project in South America, we were trying to optimize the location of the dams. So, you know, we're not going to come in and say, well, you can't build this dam. I mean, it's their country. I mean, we're trying to help them with the techniques and technologies and data analysis approaches to try to say, where can we locate these dams so that you maximize your hydropower and minimize your ecological impact? So we're trying to find, you know, the happy middle ground, because they're going to go in. So we can try to put them in the smartest place we can. And another thing I wanted to say too is that talking about hope a little bit about this sort of thing is, I've been involved in other stream restoration projects and dam removals and things. And from my perspective, you get the biggest bang for your buck by removing a dam. Because you pop that out and the system heals itself. And you've potentially opened up hundreds of miles of habitat that has been closed off. And a lot of stream restoration projects are usually small scale. You know, like a big one might be, you know, a kilometer or two, that would be a big one. So it's just, that's sort of a band-aid. You're sort of fixing this one little narrow portion of the stream. And oftentimes, you know, rivers are hard to predict, they're dynamic, there's big floods that you don't anticipate. And you put all this effort and engineering and money into stabilizing and restoring this one section of stream. You know, sometimes they just completely fail and or require a lot more maintenance than you required, than you might have estimated. So, and you haven't really fixed a lot of times the root cause. Why does this particular section of the stream need to be restored? A lot of times the answer is up in the watershed, the impacts that are driving this disequilibrium state are really up further, and you're not necessarily fixing that. So you're kind of treating a symptom, maybe not always the actual cause. In some cases you are. I don't want to denigrate stream restoration, but if I were to put my money somewhere, you know, and if I could identify a dam that's blocking a lot of habitat, I'd pull that out. And you can really let nature just restore itself that way. So, yeah, it's a very effective means of restoration. So I'm very hopeful that the more dams that we remove that don't serve a purpose, and there are aesthetic purposes, there are fishing, and there's all sorts of other reasons why people might want to keep the dam. It's not the dam, it's the pond usually. And we, you know, so we always try to recognize and balance all these things, but.
Okay. And that is it. And it would not
be. Oh, we got a question up here.
Oh, yeah.
So I live on the American River in Sacramento, and the dam, Folsom Dam, is about 10 miles upstream. And, you know, it's in order to keep the salmon fishery going, the salmon swim up to the dam, the fish and wildlife people kill the salmon, take the eggs, raise them in the fish hatchery, put it back into the river, and go back downstream. So that's the solution. And obviously there's some real problems with that. You see, is there an alternative? Especially because the river or the dam is crucial to sort of flood control in Sacramento.
Right. Yeah.
And that's happened a lot too, with some dams that didn't really serve necessarily. They won't necessarily install for specifically flood control. But what they found is, you know, they build a dam is kind of up in the middle of nowhere when they first build it, and then, well, development happens, and you know, and it happens below the dam, and so the dam ends up actually, you know. Ends up being kind of a critical piece of water infrastructure, trying and protecting all of this development that slowly happened over the decades downstream, and so that ends up being an issue a lot of times. And I'm sure they've I'm not familiar with this particular dam, but I'm sure they've probably investigated alternatives. And it seems like Fish Ladder, in their case, wasn't at the top of the list. It seems like they're going this more odd, artificial, manual route of, you know, actually raising them in a hatchery. But you know, I don't know what's more effective. I assume that they did that based, you know, on a data-driven approach. So I'd have to look at the system and figure out why it is they took that. But I presume they did so with the best data at hand. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question? I don't know. It's sort of I don't know, but.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Well, we haven't talked your ear off. That we went right up to the hour mark there. But thank you all so much for coming.
Thanks for coming.